So today is May 19th, 2018. I'm Sarah Lang with the Oral History Program at UW-Madison. I'm talking with Marta Gomez, book artist, UW alum, and head of the Book Conservation Laboratory at Memorial Library at her house in Madison. So Marta, you grew up in Columbia. Could you talk a little bit about what it was like there?
I grew up in a big family.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of interest in visual arts in my family, and applied arts in particular,
mm-hmm.
architecture, engineering, photography. I grew up in going to Catholic schools where the emphasis is in making you a good wife, I guess. So I did a lot of sewing, and it's a great education. Catholic mm-hmm. schools have very good curriculums, but I did some art, but it wasn't a big emphasis in anything in particular. We learned how to do certain, probably home economics, mm-hmm. in one of our classes. And in my vacation, Colombia doesn't have summer camps. So during vacation time, as I was a little older, I started taking some craft workshops,
mm-hmm.
and did some painting in wood, and did other things with fabrics.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I had a lot of pleasure working with my hands. I was never so good at the classes in the school because
mm-hmm.
We needed to know how to knit, to make a little outfit for babies, or to do things for the woman. So that was not that interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started taking these art workshops, like craft workshops, that's when I realized that I really enjoyed working with paint and brushes and tools to carve in the wood. And that was probably my beginning. And later on, my brother took up photography. He had a lab in the house. I started getting more interested in attending exhibitions. And
mm-hmm.
then when I decided to time came to go to the university,
mm-hmm.
I was interested in going into the arts,
mm-hmm.
To the disappointment of my father in particular, because he was hoping I was going to be an architect or an engineer, which is another trait of my family.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of cousins are civil engineers in particular, and art didn't seem like a big thing for him in particular. My mom was very supportive of
mm-hmm.
and I went into art. I was accepted at a very good university, the National University
mm-hmm.
of Colombia, which is has a really good reputation in Colombia. It's difficult to get in, so
mm-hmm.
I was very proud, and they were very proud that I was able to get in. My brother was already in that university doing architecture, and in the first year I just took classes like everybody does, general classes, drawing, and we had to decide in the second year
mm-hmm.
what we wanted to do. And I've been, since very young, very detail-oriented, and I did like always to have things specifically organized. So a lot of things didn't seem to have that as part of their, when I was taking these classes in ceramics, and it was a little more loose, a little more messy.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started taking graphic design, I thought that that's what I was more ready to do,
mm-hmm.
because graphic design really demands a lot of different attention to a lot of detail in typography, page design. And in the program, we were exposed to different kinds of design, graphic design, a corporate image, which has to do with logo, has to do with letters, and how to use that for the letterhead of the company, the business cards. And I loved all that. I love working with space and text. And then we did also books. And I started working with primarily books that had some didactic purpose, which they were more geared to children. So I work with the alphabet book. And I then took packaging design. And packaging design, you learn to work with paper, of course, with making different folds in the paper to make the paper strong. It was not quite like origami. I never did origami, but we needed to do enclosures for things out of just maybe paper stack, a little thicker than regular paper. And then I realized that I could combine that with books, because I liked the idea of books that were more three-dimensional. So I did a few things, but in that, at the time, the books that I did, I only designed them. And there were some where I had more, you know, I was more involved in the book structure. But as far as printing, we had to do it with, at the time there were first no computers, and also we just used very mechanical kind of way of doing it. So when I was doing logos, which I also enjoyed, and we needed to do a final thing, we actually designed it and then give it to somebody that was the technician to actually print it on the card. So we never, there was kind of a gap in between making things and the results of things. In the books, I had a little more control, a little more to do with the book. They were never additioned, because some of the books were kind of involved. They were just projects. So we were not expected to addition things. I also worked on poster design, on billboard designs. And when I finished my degree, I was fortunate enough that I got a job in graphic design, more in the commercial aspect of it. So it was a large company, and I was part of, well, it wasn't necessarily a huge office where I was, but for a way too long, I was doing the same thing. It was pasting text on things that I didn't have too much space for creativity. I was told what to do, where to put the text, how to line everything. And it's probably how these jobs start. You know, you need to do very repetitive work. And I lost my fascination for that kind of work. And I started looking into other possibilities, and I had some friends that had taken time to go abroad and get a little, you know, more exposure to the world. And I decided to probably try that, but my first concern was the language. So I decided on coming to the United States, making a decision that seemed very good at the time. And it didn't really turn out to be the place for me. I grew up in a big city, Bogota, the capital, and I was, you know, exposed to a lot of cultural activities. You know, like big cities always offer. And I chose Nebraska, Omaha, because I thought that nobody that spoke Spanish was gonna be there. Meaning everybody went to Miami, to New York, to California, to Texas. Those were the destinations, and they never really learned much English. So I was very conscious about that, and I looked through the different possibilities that offer these programs, English as a second language, and I chose Omaha. And in many ways, was a good experience to be somewhere else, but the city didn't provide what was fulfilling to me. And I was learning some English, of course, but most of the people that were in my classes were at the same level, so the English really never was. And the fact that I also felt very limited to explore the city, I didn't have a car, and I, you know, I was also in classes, and we were taken to places where we were treated more like, and I felt treated more like a kid, because we were trying to express ourselves, and when you are learning a language, that's sometimes how it comes out a little. And I decided that, you know, it was not the place I should have gone, but I didn't have any other plan. So I met, well, I lived with a family, and that was very nice. I met nice people. Wasn't that. But it was kind of in the middle of nowhere. For me, that area, that place.
And can you tell us, like, about what time this was? Was it in the, like, early 80s? Or?
That was in the early 80s, and I'm sure things have changed. Like, everywhere else is becoming a little more lively, these places. In fact, Omaha has a very good, I don't know if they still do, but there was a printing, letterpress printing facility within the university. I don't think it was in the time I was there, and at the time I wasn't exposed to this, so I wasn't looking for these things. The university where the program was housed, it was housed there, but it didn't really belong to the university. But we were able to use some of the facilities, so the museum wasn't very exciting, what they have. So things were very, to me, things were very slow, and I was in contact with my friends back in Colombia, and they were all doing really interesting things, and I felt very homesick in many ways. I felt that my experience was okay. I was fortunate to have it, but I thought it was gonna be just time for me to move on. And I met two people there, two sisters from Bolivia. They were in the program, and one of them was coming to Madison. She had she was going to be in radiology as a technician, so it was only a 2-year program. So we kept in touch when I was still in Omaha, and she said, maybe you want to come to this city. It's lively, a lot of things going on, is beautifully located, has a great university, and she was very happy in the program. And she, of course, wrote to me this soon after she left, because we were feeling a little out of sorts in Omaha. She knew that I was really probably just getting myself out of Omaha. And we destination back to Colombia. But then she said, why don't you come here and stop and stay here for some time? And I stopped in my way, really. I took a bus and never had taken a ride that long. Actually, Omaha was my very first experience alone, away from my family.
Mm-hmm.
And my family is families in Colombia are very close. And mine is not different. I'm the youngest in my family, so I was very independent, when I was in Colombia, as independent as we can be in a big family. And maybe for that reason, my mom was so supportive mm-hmm. of letting me go, because she knew I needed that. But I was also feeling, when I was here, that independency that I had, I couldn't really exercise it here because I had limitations. I needed a little more of the language. I was in a place that wasn't offering many things. So I decided, well, maybe it's not. This is not for me. Maybe I'm going back, and I stopped here in Madison. And it was lovely. It was probably April into May, think. And she had already made some friends
mm-hmm.
and an interesting group of people, and they were all talking about how wonderful the university was, and that it has a very strong art department, especially printmaking was top of, I think it still is considered pretty strong, but at the time everybody was talking about it, and I thought maybe I will give it a try. I applied, and I was accepted. There was a process, of course, because mm-hmm. I didn't have my portfolio from Colombia here. I had to do a portfolio when I graduated there, and that probably alone was not going to help me to get into the program here. So I was accepted as a special student,
mm-hmm.
and that's how I started taking some courses that I needed as requirements that I didn't have when my transcripts were sent. And one of the courses was in typography. Another one was in serigraphy. As I said, we didn't do a lot of technical. We didn't have access to a shop where they did serigraphy, and it was very needed. So, especially in graphic design, posters and that, we were actually only had the concept of the poster and gave it to somebody else to do it. So here, having the chance to learn all that, and because it was a requirement, I took these classes. And my first class in typography was with Phil Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And Phil Hamilton was more into graphic design.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little, because I didn't want to go into graphic design again. But I thought it probably is going to be different here. It will be advanced in many ways. If that was my calling, so I took typography with Phil, and that was my first exposure to letterpress printing, and it was second nature to me, even though I'd never done it,
mm-hmm.
because I loved the attention to detail. It's very meticulous mm-hmm. kind of craft, requires patience, and I feel I had all those skills. I just needed to explore more. And I started doing typography in a different, I think we had to do different aspects of, like, a broadside. We even did also a business card, a letterhead, but all in this new technique that it was so new to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that my work was somewhat unusual, the way I approached the book, especially when we had to design a book. I had the skills because I always loved working with three-dimensional things. And I think it came from my classes in packaging design.
Okay.
And knowing how to fold paper to make interesting structures. So I did a book that actually called the attention of my professor at the time, and he was very encouraging to pursue that. I did a book that was about vowels,
mm-hmm.
and it was the content was a poem by Rambo, and it was in a hexagon shape, and the stanzas, every one of the pages that was attached to the side of the hexagon up and up, and the poem was printed in letterpress, and then in the following page was the letter that the poem was written for, the vowel.
Okay.
So the it became very dynamic, that structure. It's hard to explain the structure, but when the hexagon is completely open, it opens, it looks like a flower. You see all the stances, and if you turn it over, you see all the designs of the letter. So I used the letter in wood type,
mm-hmm.
and I made designs just using that particular vowel. So it became also very abstract because I love designing with just one letter,
mm-hmm.
And just play with it and making, sometimes the letter is perfectly identified and sometimes it becomes an abstract design. So I loved working my first time also with wood type. I had the background of the working with type at that level, but not doing it myself, the printing and saying. So that was kind of for me and a big discovery,
mm-hmm.
where I was able to do everything on my own. I was taking other classes and I was trying to catch up with the requirements to present my portfolio. And I was accepted in the MFA program after a semester and a summer.
Sure.
And when I finally entered into the MFA program, I wanted to work with Walter Hamedy,
mm-hmm.
because he had a different approach to the book.
Mm-hmm.
He was more into fine print, what it's called in the book arts.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on a sabbatical.
Okay.
So I took another class with Phil. Phil is very enthusiastic, so it was always very encouraging. And I took photography, and I kept doing some serigraphy with Dean Meeker. And then it came this question about me. It was I was confronted with a new, by my professors,
mm-hmm.
with a kind of a new identity of my ethnicity.
Okay.
That I was never aware of. Because in Colombia, I grew up in a very urban environment. I was also, middle class, very solid middle class. So I went to a good university. I at the university we did our curriculum in art, was with a lot of exposure to European art,
mm-hmm.
American art. But my professors were wondering why I wasn't, you know, like they wanted me to project some tribal persona.
Oh, really?
And then I realized that I do have very strong Indian features, but I wasn't aware of it myself. Because Colombia population is also very mixed,
mm-hmm.
you know. Indian and Spanish came together, and that's a big part of the population. And of course there are many other types, like any other culture has very different types. People as fair as you, blonde, blue eyes in certain regions. But I just happen to have also very strong Indian features, and I recognize that
mm-hmm.
then. And I just, people kept asking me that, for instance, is one of my pieces, and I
mm-hmm.
do work with very abstract forms. I when I do flat work, and even when I do my work in books,
mm-hmm.
I like geometric shapes and playing with that. And I then started doing things that turned out to be interesting, very interesting to me, but the intention was to show them then, yes, well, I can investigate my ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a major book with pre-Columbian objects that were from peoples from Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
Exclusively, because it's pre-Columbian in Mexico, pre-Columbian in Peru, pre-Columbian in many parts of South America. So I investigated this, I did the research, and I was very grateful that I didn't just do it with the intention of, you know, giving them the pleasure of seeing something tribal, but I then realized how fantastic the design sensibility and not just very, very sophisticated
mm-hmm.
Design, the pre-Columbian cultures in my country, how they approach this. I did a book on rodillos, which are rollers made from ceramic stone,
mm-hmm.
and they carved, and when they are rotated on a flat surface, they create these designs.
Mm-hmm.
A pattern, and that was used to print their faces.
Okay.
And they prepared their own inks in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they incorporated those designs also in fabrics, in clothing. And I did one, I realized there was one that was a clenched fist, and when it rolled over the surface, printed an open hand.
Interesting.
And I was completely overwhelmed by that sophistication in that period.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the patterns, I actually went to Colombia, talked to some people that own these rollers, took pictures. I also found in some books the designs that they display as they were rolled on the fabrics, and the designs are as contemporary mm-hmm. as any design, and they just beautiful designs, very geometric, and I loved it. I guess in Colombia we, of course, we know the where we're coming from, but we are never encouraged to appropriate those things to be part of our way of expressing our creativity, because that's not, you know, those were done then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I wanted to do this book just as a research book.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it as artistically as I could to, you know, be able to present it as a, there were plates practically that if they could have been framed if they wanted to, with the roller printed in serigraphy, and then what I thought the roller would look when rolled over on cloth, and I printed that on a fabric just also to show that some of the uses of those rollers were for that purpose. But I also found it printed on faces, and that's very striking
mm-hmm.
When you see it on a face, the same patterns. And so I did a series of, I did another couple of books where one has to do more with African imagery.
Mm-hmm.
They're three-dimensional. They are based on an accordion structure, and that was, these books were very visual, primarily visual. I incorporated a little bit of text that was letterpress printed, and I always was looking at books that were beautifully not a lot of text. See, what I did with these books that were primarily visual was, for me, the most important part was the visual aspect, the imagery that was treated very three-dimensionally. And I did the introduction to give an idea of the book, but I wanted to be able to work with more text. And when I finally was able to work with Walter Hamady, we took our first trip to the Red Book Collection to look at artist books.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a revelation for me when I saw these just beautiful books that were very much like the codex. You just turn the pages. And some of the books only had text printed
mm-hmm.
with just a design or just a change of color in the line.
Mm-hmm.
Just one word was printed in a different color. And the way the type was printed into this beautiful handmade paper was very, to me, was just beautiful. There was a beauty in it that was hard to explain, because there was nothing, it was not that, actually it was very magical. There was no, nothing different from the way you open other books, mm-hmm. regular books.
Yeah.
But it was how the words were just printed in this page, and how the titles were done, and how settled the and quiet, and at the same time sensual this mm-hmm. media was. So I just wanted to do some more text, but I'm not a, I don't write, I don't keep a journal, I don't write poetry. I was looking for good text, and that I knew what a good text was.
Mm-hmm.
But also because of the language, I was able to express myself. I was able to, read English poetry, or poetry in English. But I started working with a poet. I did a book. Maybe that wasn't the first one, but I did a book with a Spanish poet.
Mm-hmm.
And using primarily the text. Oh, I was also already making paper, and that was another aspect of another class that I loved, just how magical it is to do. To make paper, and I was making paper for printing, so it requires a different skill that when you use it as a piece, like when people do different pulp on the paper, collage, you're more free to do different things on the paper. I wanted the paper to be printed on. So, and I also love that, being able to get as, good every time you win and make more paper. And it requires a lot of trying because of the strength that you need to lift the mold from the water and get an even, perfectly even paper. So when I finally was able to get my paper to be good to print on, I use a little bit of a pulp to design on every sheet. And then that paper, I used it just to print these points. And
Marta, do you remember who you took paper making with?
Yes, with Walter.
You did, okay.
Yeah, Walter was a big influence in my work. He was an extraordinary teacher, difficult person as well, very inspiring. His typography is exquisite, and also he was a very good paper maker.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I did paper making with him. Primarily. And then I was told that maybe I should have some English also to go along with my books, because then it limited the accessibility for people to enjoy the book.
Because you were working with the Spanish poems. Okay.
Spanish language,
right?
And I thought it was interesting because sometimes these books, like songs, you don't need to understand the words for you to like the melody,
mm-hmm.
and you think it's just so beautiful and it really touches you. I knew a lot of songs that I never knew what the text said. It was just so many other things that were beautiful about it, and then I learned English, and then I listened to the same piece of music, and I was able to understand, and in some ways it was as beautiful as I thought it was before I learned the language. So sometimes you don't need to understand everything that is, and I think that's also why when I went to the Rare Book collection to look at these books, I wasn't even reading the poems.
Mm-hmm.
I was just seeing the poems printed, how beautiful the effect was. So I thought, yeah, maybe that's right. You know, I should do some books in English.
Mm-hmm.
And I work with another poet. He's in the public domain. And his work is very, his words are very visual too. The lines, playful. And also with a lot of feeling, like poetry is. And I did a broadside that I made it into a book because of the way it opened.
Mm-hmm.
Started out as a broadside because broadside is just one page, a flat page that has all the elements of the book.
Okay.
And that's how my structure was. But when I folded it, I was able to sew it. But I could definitely show it as a broadside. Then it was folded, and it was made into a small book. And it gave me the possibility to have the poem in Spanish and the poem in English.
Do you remember which poet that was?
Yeah, Vallejo.
Okay.
Peruvian.
Mm-hmm.
Cesar Vallejo.
Okay.
And I just happened to, that was a student project.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not checking with copyright.
Okay.
And that's your field. I mean, you work in publishing, so.
Sure.
So I use a translation, but I gave credit in my colophon to the
okay.
translator.
Sure.
I don't know if that should be there. And I thought it was enough. I was not going to do anything with the book. It was a class project.
Sure. It wasn't for sale.
It wasn't for sale. Mm-hmm. But I additioned it because Walter required
mm-hmm.
an edition of the book. We always gave him a copy, and we kept our copies. And I thought, well, why not? Escherman was the poet that translated Vallejo.
Mm-hmm.
He himself is a poet.
Okay.
And, well, that was very well received, that book, you know, the fact that I made a broadside into a practically a book, with, and the way that the translation was revealed as you unfolded the page was also played really well with the whole book. And then I wanted to move on and do maybe look for things that were not poetry.
Sure.
And at the time I had met Ivan. I met Ivan
mm-hmm.
at the beginning of my studies. And I thought...
How did you meet?
Oh, we just met at a social event.
Okay.
It was not university related. It was just a gathering for a friend that was having a birthday,
mm-hmm.
and Austrian,
mm-hmm.
and his Italian friend was very good friend. Lived all in the same building. He was in. So he invited us and my roommates,
mm-hmm.
my Bolivian friends, and Ivan had just come back from Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Is I don't know for how long he was in Italy. And he had met a man that taught, I think he taught Italian to the pro, to the some American program
mm-hmm.
in Florence. So he wanted to come to the States, and Ivan said, well, I think that you could try to come and teach Italian in the Italian department for a year as a visiting professor, and you can, if you want, live in my house.
Okay.
And Ivan was divorced, had been divorced at the time for some years, so he was here, and he got invited to the party.
Okay.
So that's how we met. And he t- told me he was a professor in philosophy, which I found very interesting, although I never really did. I did philosophy, but not very well. That was part of my curriculum in high school.
Sure.
You know, he spoke Italian, I spoke Spanish. And that worked really well because I do understand Italian. It's very close. I mean, it's not. But I was very shy with English. And,
okay.
And that made it even, I made it very comfortable. And he has always been fascinated with languages.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew a little Spanish, although his Italian was. And we just met at that party, and then later on, not immediately, the relationship developed.
Sure.
And I told him that I was just been accepted in the program.
Okay.
I think I had been here because I was getting my portfolio for it.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you were saying that you wanted to work with material other than poems.
Other than poems. So I asked him if he, and I didn't know if he understood exactly what text a person that do this work in this media needs, because an academics write a lot,
yes,
long essays, you know, so I said, no, do you have any text that is kind of interesting, just not poetry, I'm not looking for poetry, but things that are printable in this type of books? But he had only seen the books that I did with not a lot of text, the ones that were very visual, three-dimensional. And he said, well, I was interested at one point early in his life in aphorisms. And he wrote counter aphorisms.
Okay.
And he loves playing with words, and mm-hmm. you know, they had this interesting kind of take on the aphorism, with sometimes completely taking the aphorism apart, because everybody likes to say, oh, you know, what kills me makes me stronger. That sounds great, yeah. And his response was very, I loved it, you know, because he says, no, but whatever diminishes me kills me somehow,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it's true, people like to use aphorisms in a very loose way, just to, they become cliches, mm-hmm. in many ways. So I thought, that's perfect. How many do you have? He said, well, I might have had, he had a number. And he also had a little poem that was very, just a few lines and punctuations, one word and punctuation. And I thought, that's perfect. I mean, mm-hmm. that really is gonna fit. And he was a little concerned how this was gonna be illustrated. Mm-hmm. And he was hesitant, but I guess at the time he thought, well, it's in your hands. And he always left in the summer,
mm-hmm.
to go to Germany. He does German philosophy, and he liked to spend the summers at the time in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the text, and that was a challenge for me, because I usually worked in things that were, I didn't want to illustrate it. That a lot of those aphorisms cannot be illustrated, but I wanted to have a feeling for them, like some atmospheric kind of imagery,
mm-hmm.
that set the tone for what does not kill me may make me stronger, you know, like, yeah, that needs to be very also abstract, but creating a feeling. And my friend, my very good friend at the time, she's no longer in town, but was a lithographer, mm-hmm. and I'm just a masterful lithographer. And I asked her if she wanted to collaborate in this project. And that's what is also beautiful about books. You could collaborate with people. And she looked at the text and she got very interested. And I like her imageries. It's also, it always, when you look at her work, you really can feel it. It's sometimes very abstract,
mm-hmm.
but it's very loaded with feeling. And I thought, this is why I asked her. And she did beautiful lithographs. Just beautiful lithographs for
and
this.
What is your friend's name? What was your friend's name?
Phyllis McGibbon.
Okay.
She's primarily a printmaker, a lithographer. She did etching. She does many things and books. And when she does books, they are, she doesn't work in that media very much, but the ones she's done are very beautiful, well thought out. The imagery is very complex. And so she collaborated with me, mm-hmm. and it was printed from the stone, and it was on my handmade paper, which could be a challenge because there are paper exclusively for lithograph. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's made for that, and I wanted to do it in my own paper, so we worked very intensely, and it was a very small addition. But I still wanted to addition because it was going to be more text set than I ever did before. And I thought it was a nice thing to addition. And we did a 30, I think it was 30, yeah, copies.
Mm-hmm.
And when the book was done, I had designed the structure of the book, and I had also designed how the book was going to be sewn and covers, how it was going to be bound. And when Ivan returned from Germany, I said, oh, the book is done, the book is finished. And he said, I would love to see it. And when he saw the book, his first question is, how many copies? Because he thought, I said, oh, many, 30. 30 is actually could be, for a book like that, at this moment I don't remember exactly how many lithographs, but a lot of lithographs.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, 30? How is that possible? Only 30? I said, only? You have no idea what it takes to do these books. And so he was completely shocked. He loved it.
Uh-huh.
He couldn't believe what it has been done with the text. And he confessed that he was very hesitant,
mm-hmm.
about the graphics on that were going with the text. And he suddenly got very enthusiastic about doing more projects,
mm-hmm.
and I still had the type set. I said, well, there are only 30 copies with the lithographs, but if you want, we can print a book that is in commercial paper, wouldn't have the lithos, but it will have the text, and it will be exactly the same without the lithos. And there was a little poem in it, and that I was able to do it. The poem didn't have any litho. So I said, and that one will be intact. The way I broke the lines, it was nice because it needed the poses was a very minimalist poem. So we made another, probably another 20 copies of a second edition without the images, and he was able to give it away to his family, to because he wanted to share that book. And then when we decided to collaborate again with him, and you know, working on the text, and Phyllis working on the lithographs, because we both were very happy with the results, the three of us, so we made 60.
Okay.
And that was a big number, because you know, I like also to make boxes for my books. Mm-hmm. All my books are boxed, so it becomes a big project. But it's what I love about that media. It's very intimate. It's very, you are practically in contact with every step, mm-hmm, of that, you know, the paper making, the setting of the type, the designing of the structure, and the execution of the printing, which is, you know, as a student of water, very, very focused on how the impression in the paper, everything, and it's something that when the viewer is interacting with the book, I want the viewer to experience the book intellectually and tactically, and in order to have that experience, because I want them to have the experience I had the first time I look at one of these books. It's just that you just touch the paper, and it's in itself very sensual. I think that books is a multi-sensual experience. Books of some sorts. Book arts comes in so many different ways now, and with when I did book arts, when I was working, when I did my MFA, computers were not available the way they are now.
Sure.
And the temptation of using so many different typefaces is, people cannot resist. Mm-hmm. So the pages are crowded, and they could have a beauty in that crowdedness. You know, that if you know how to use type well, that always works well. But when what you look for is simplicity and just the focus on the, well, is I don't work with computers much. I use it as a tool, mm-hmm, to set up text that is shaped, and then I try to do it in the letterpress. Following letterpress is very tricky because of spacing.
Sure.
So sometimes that you can do in the computer and shape it into a parallelogram, mm-hmm, might not translate very well when you're setting it in letterpress. I don't like to use a lot of hyphens, mm-hmm, in paragraphs. That I learned from Walter.
Okay.
If you look at, and he uses a lot of text in his books. Mm-hmm. And hardly ever, and he shapes, sometimes he has shapes, and but he writes his own text, mm-hmm, and you can do that. You can just change the wording and might be able to fix it. So, yeah, but I've seen some digital books that are called artist books that are nice. I never really seen them in websites.
Sure.
Yeah. And so I cannot say I have hold one and have the experience that I have when I hold a handmade letterpress printed book.
Sure.
Yeah.
So when you were studying graphic design in Columbia, you weren't using computers then,
oh, no,
right?
No. That's even... no. Computers were not used, so we did a lot of paste up, mm-hmm, you know, we One of the books that I did in Colombia had to do with the alphabet. And each page, which a letter of the alphabet, had lines that started with that letter,
mm-hmm.
but also reflect, like for the L, I talked about lines, and I actually, we were encouraged to look in magazine and do cutouts, and then try to space them in the page, and that was also very challenging, but interesting, because you look for different typefaces that went together, and you, that I wrote, you know, I had to write something which every line started with the letter that I was trying to portray in that page. And I did it, I did a whole alphabet.
Okay.
And, yeah, no, computers. And we didn't have in my school access to technology. That's why I never really did serigraphy.
Mm-hmm.
We just designed on paper. And did letters also with tools that were appropriate and stencils.
Okay.
That's.
I would think that that background really helped you when you started working in book arts then.
Oh, tremendously. That was probably also what, how, my skills were shaped,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that I had, I liked that kind of work that was very detailed and that was time consuming, but art is ceramics. I mean, even paintings, printmaking, everything is time consuming, but there is something about working with letters that could be very, and that's why people now that grew up in the computer world, they love the letterpress when they are exposed to it, and they're gonna do it, and they hate the process because it's not immediate.
Mm-hmm.
I have students in the conservation lab who take classes in the art department, and they're interested in the book printing, which is now not as it was when
mm-hmm.
Walter is it, they is less required to do a lot of projects in the press. It's a little more free, which is good because you still want them to learn book structure, sewings, and incorporate the text however you want. So some people do handwriting, which is also very beautiful, and different things. But it is taught, and I think everybody has access to, I mean, they have to do something. One of the projects where they include a line or a poem or a, in letterpress. So it's done. But in my time, was intensely letterpress.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, was actually what I thought needed to be. You need to be patient, you need to be very demanding with yourself, and, you know, how to choose. I love to be able to choose different typefaces, the ones that were available. And Walter's shop was impeccable. He made everybody distribute type, so it was also, you need to have a shop where you go in and you're gonna be productive,
mm-hmm.
because if you don't find the letters in the place where that letter is going to be, or you find the letter but from another type face, you might lose your patience and you get frustrated easily. And maybe I didn't have those frustrations, so if I did, was because the letter was a little broken. So there is that part of letterpress printing. It's slow.
Mm-hmm.
It could be tedious because you need to set it, You need to prove it, you need to change it, and even the spaces between letters, sometimes you use paper. There are many different spacing material that okay. comes with the case, but you, even the thinnest one, sometimes it's not, sometimes it's too thick, and you just want to add a paper space.
Okay.
So you need all that when you really want to make the space right. Other people are not interested in that, and it's perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I think maybe because that's what I remember being for me, that wonderful experience when I first looked at a book, and I probably one of those books was by Walter. There was another mentor. Of course, Walter was my teacher, but he wasn't around all the time because he couldn't be. But there was a classmate that became as much as a mentor as Walter was to me.
Mm-hmm.
And her name is Kathy King.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I also admire her work tremendously. She has one of the most impeccable printing skills. She made the most beautiful paper. Actually, I learned paper from Walter, but Kathy was always around, and she was very generous with her time. So it was, if I was having any problems, I talked to her and she said, oh, I will stop. So she was super helpful. And there was somebody else that, Bunny Stalker.
Mm-hmm.
She was advanced. When I started, she was much ahead of my class, and she was the one that taught me a lot of non-adhesive bindings.
Okay.
And because that wasn't part of the curriculum.
So when did you learn that from her?
Oh, at the same time I was developing my work, especially when I started doing the fine press,
mm-hmm.
using more text in the books, less three-dimensional. I still, even when I was learning those skills, those binding skills from Bunny, I just wanted to learn different kinds of bindings.
Okay.
And sometimes I use them in not that I incorporated all of them in my work, but I also took a class from Jim Dast,
mm-hmm.
because he was the conservator for many years at the university, and he was offered a bookbinding class where we could get credit from.
Okay.
He's taking his class. It was just one credit, and we paid separately, not part of our tuition.
Okay.
So, and he did one semester class,
uh-huh.
where we met once a week, and he became another mentor to me. We did more traditional bookbinding.
Sure.
And we did. I also learned tremendously from him. Because it's very important to know traditional bookbinding before you start experimenting,
mm-hmm.
with other types of bindings. I think the codex is very important to know. And that was one of my attractions when I always wanted to work in that lab, because I knew he hired students. Kathy Keane worked for him many years. And another person that, that was very influential to me was Jim.
And did you eventually work with him in the conservation lab?
Yes, he finally moved to a bigger facility, so he had got more money, mm-hmm. to hire people, because apparently the money was spent in making the facility bigger.
Okay.
He was the conservator of that library, which is a large library. Mm-hmm. And he had a corner of a space, very small. And I think many people worked for him that were in the art department. Mm-hmm. They got, I mean, it was, it's a great job to have when you're interested in books. Mm-hmm. Because you learn about paper, you learn about, you have to take sometimes the book apart, the book that you're repairing.
Sure.
And you, when you're repairing the book, you have to clean the spine and you can see the different bindings that were done and how covers were attached. And so I learned a lot from Jim Dast. And when I finally was able to work in his, I had already finished my MFA. Mm-hmm. And in order to continue being able to work as a, you know, a student in the university, I had to be a student. So I was able to take one class as a special student again. Mm-hmm. And I took paper making because having accessibility to paper, paper making became a big technique in my life. I was planning to return to Colombia.
Okay.
And maybe that made our relationship even better because we were enjoying our relationship very much without any pressures. Mm-hmm. And I was going to set up a paper mill. That was my big plan, because I don't think book arts was known in Colombia. Mm-hmm. But if I started making paper and teaching some workshops in book structure and mm-hmm. book binding, that was my way of maybe continuing doing my personal work. It's not a scene in Colombia, book arts, in the way it is here. It is in Europe, where you actually can sell books to a collection. That is now. But papermaking, I thought I could really do something with it. So, papermaking was very, very important to me. And that's why I wanted to become a very good paper maker, which takes time.
So was that a second class in paper making that you took after you graduated, or did you take your first class in paper making when you were done?
I took my first class, and you know, you're always, just by doing it, you get to be good. Mm-hmm. You take a class, you learn how to see that the right amount of beading is, the pulp is right for the paper. You learn all the technical aspects of the book, and then you incorporate, I'd like to incorporate painting on my, but just so it is almost not, when I did painting on my own paper with pulp, there was no different thickness in any, it was just there. Mm-hmm. And so I learned different things with paper making. At the time, I never dyed my paper, which you could learn. I wanted my paper to be natural colors. Okay. So when I went looking for material to make the paper, usually went to Goodwill, mm-hmm. because you want fabrics that have been washed a lot, that are somewhat old. Mm-hmm. And that was the place where I went looking for secondhand corduroy, linen, cotton. And if I was looking for a specific color of paper, I tried to find that, those materials that had that color, and you couldn't really have it as the way you envision it, but it was close enough.
Sure.
And then when I started making my additions larger, and I was already, of course, very aware that there were beautiful handmade paper for sale. And especially Japanese papers are thinner, and my papers were a little thicker,
mm-hmm.
and you want sometimes different quality in the paper. So I started buying handmade paper. But I remember enjoying making, I haven't made paper in a long time,
mm-hmm.
in a long time. And, but it was magic. It was just probably as magic as when you do your first, you pull out your first print on the letterpress, you know, you just set all this type, do all these things, and suddenly you put your paper through, and there is, you know, beautiful type printed on paper. But, yeah, I was fortunate that there were so many things coming together at the same time, and there were so many talented people around me. A lot of talent at the time, a lot of interest in letterpress, and we were trading books, and it was just delightful to be able to just, you know, be able to do that with your colleagues, and many of them went and did very well in the different parts where they settled.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed here because then my relationship became very important to me. I decided to stay. My work was being well received. And talking about this Eshelman translator,
mm-hmm.
I was already finished with school and I was working here in my studio, and I got a telephone call from him. And the fact was that a dealer came through town, a major dealer that was based in Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
Steve Clay, and he dealt primarily poetry,
okay,
and artist books. He had a beautiful store in Minnesota. I finally once visited, and he asked Walter if he had any talented student that he was willing to look at the work, and Walter said, you should look into Martha's work. And at the time I was working at the Silver Buckle Press.
Okay.
Under Kathy ran the Silver Buckle Press for many years. But I was never able to work when Kathy, I was still in a school,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't as easy for foreign students to get jobs like it is now. Now, as long as you are a student, you can get a job. So I could never, Walter wanted me to be his lab assistant, I could never get a job.
Okay.
You had to be, you know, a citizen. So you could be from out of state, but a citizen.
Sure.
And a lot of people came already with TA jobs, teaching assistant jobs, which is what gives you experience when you want to go and teach somewhere else. And that was actually not accessible to me.
Okay. How did you feel about that?
Well, it was frustrating.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't sure I wanted to teach necessarily, but I wanted to be able to have a job.
Yeah.
And it was until for some reason, I not only was able to keep my job. What happened? Because I think that I wasn't yet married when I was working. Because I was a resident, but I still needed to be a student to be able to get a student status. I worked in the conservation lab. The conservation lab never hired anybody as long as they were not. You needed to be a student. It's the same with me. My help, mm-hmm. is all students. When once they graduate, even if they want to stay, I couldn't hire them. There is no money to hire outside people. So maybe that's maybe one of the reasons I started working in the, I was working in the Silver Packard Press under Barbara Dinbaum. Mm-hmm. And then I was able to, later, much later, this is when I stopped working in the Silver Packard Press, Jim had a job for me.
Okay.
But Jim already knew my work because actually when I had my MFA, he was very helpful. He was, giving me ideas in how to present the book. He did some book stands for me.
Oh.
And he loved... I think he liked my work, and I took that class for longer than I should have because I love working in this traditional way as well. And mm-hmm. I thought that once you take one class, you need another class because you only do one sample for the different kinds of traditional bookbinding.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to repeat it, and I took another class, and I got to know him a little better, and so... it was very, very difficult to be able to make any money. I once got a job as a TA, but in the Spanish department. I was still working on my MFA, and my MFA actually I graduated later than expected. Because I practically took a year off to be a TA, and I was doing my art history classes.
Oh, okay.
Not studio classes. The studio classes were too demanding.
Mm-hmm.
So I took my requirements in art history. And I was a TA, and I was able to make not just a little money, but a lot of money, significant for me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because my parents were helping me. But then when I got the TA, in Spanish, and only because they needed actually people, they accepted too many freshmen that
okay.
wanted to be, it's a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they had their own graduate students that all come with assistants, job assistants, I applied, but
mm-hmm.
Colombian Spanish is considered the best Spanish outside of Spain.
Okay.
I never taught Spanish, and I still got the job, and I loved it. I just loved teaching it. I learned a lot. I
mm-hmm.
took a class in the Spanish department that was considered part of my outside class and work. You needed to take a class outside the art department.
Sure.
And that was considered, that was accepted. And I learned a lot of techniques to teach, and and I had it was a lot of work because you teach every single day.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fun. So that time I made some money, which was very important to me. But then what happened was that this dealer, going back to that, liked my work, and he said, "Would you like how many copies you have?" I said, "Well, I probably have 20 copies. He said, "I would love to represent you. Is it okay if you give me this book?" And it was the book with Cesar Vallejo's poetry and Mr. Eshelman's translations. But at the time, I thought nothing of it because I should have been more aware of it, even though... if you're a printer, you should be aware that you cannot just pull out somebody's translation. But since I gave him credit, I thought, well, I'm doing the right thing. It's not like I'm just using a translation. So I get a call from Mr. Eshelman.
Okay.
And Ivan was away, and I was here in the house. And he said, I think you have done some books with Cesar Vallejo's poetry. I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "And also with my translations." I said, oh, but you know, they were a class project. I was never intended it to be, because he immediately said, and you're making some money with my work. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, but frankly, when I did it, there was no intention in selling my work. He had told me that who was selling it, and that's how he found out.
Okay.
Because he himself had a bibliographer that had, she found out all the work that was done where his work was published.
Sure.
And so I said, oh, I'm really very sorry, but what can I do? He said, well, I can sue you, you know. Or I said, but frankly, there were only 20 copies, and I don't think I don't know how many have been sold. I have really made no money significant, but if you want a copy or a number of copies, he said, I want 10% of the copies you made. And 10%, I mean, I didn't even know I'm thinking, wow, do I have any copies to send this man?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have given this dealer a few copies, but I had done a little book, like a miniature book, and that was all in English,
mm-hmm.
using only one poem. And I use it like, I don't know if you're familiar with concrete poetry,
mm-hmm.
which is very playful and the word. And Cesar Vallejo's poetry was very good for that reason. You could really make kind of playful positions of the word and make the just that as your visuals mm-hmm. in the book. And I said, he said, but you did more than one book. I said, oh, I had even forgotten about that. I said, oh, that's right. There was this other little book. It's a miniature book. And also very few copies. He said, well, I would like copies of that. So I said, well, I mean, it's good because if he sues me, you know. I said, oh, I will send you. I'm so sorry. He said, oh, who's your professor? He should talk about those things in class.
Mm-hmm.
And probably he did. You know, that's what I think. I don't think maybe he did. But since I was never planning to make any money with my work in class, and also because I was encouraged to have some English,
mm-hmm.
I found a translation. So then that was it. I sent him some copies. But he said, you're making money out of my work. I said, no, I'm not. I'm really not. But of course, it's your work. Yeah, I understand that. So that was fixed with that. And then his bibliographer calls me.
Okay.
And he said, Marta, I understand that you made two editions, one in handmade paper and the other one in regular paper. I said, yeah, I guess I did, because the handmade paper sells a little more expensive and it's boxed, and the other one, you know, is just regular paper.
Uh-huh.
So she said, well, you know what? As a bibliographer of Eschenman, I like to have and we only had the handmade paper copies. So the others, I'm willing to buy them from you.
So she
bought them. So I thought, oh, she's a bibliographer. She's buying them. So maybe everything got fixed with him. I think he probably, when he got the books, he said, oh my God. Look, it's just one poem. It was just one poem.
Mm-hmm.
So then I decided to do something else with his poetry, with Vallejo's poetry, not with Eschenman's. And Ivan translated it.
Oh, okay.
And he did a beautiful translation.
Mm-hmm.
Poetry is very difficult to translate. And I was surprised how much I liked Ivan's translation more, because we worked it out. We were talking about Ivan speaks very good Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Because I only wanted to speak Spanish at the beginning of our relationship. And he's very good at languages. He speaks a number of languages. And, you know, he studies the language. He loves the grammar. And he really wanted to do that translation. And, yeah, we were very pleased with that translation. So I was able to use another poem yet for another broadside. That was really a broadside.
Okay.
And we were very happy with it. But, yeah, it was a time when I thought Madison, and maybe because Walter was here, and the enthusiasm for the media, and of course computers were not competing at the time as they are now. And people really, I can see it, you know, the immediacy of the results. You can really work, do so much for a shop. I mean, all the different things that you can do just to try different things in the page, which is, yeah, I think it is. But I still think that what Letterpress does cannot be ever. I think what computers do now is different, it's the opposite. The text is a little a relief, you know, it's a relief. You can actually touch it and it's, but doesn't bite into the paper. I don't think it does. And you can easily, I did a lot of use of computer as a tool also to have an image that I, image that I could send to have a plate made to do letterpress.
Sure.
So, but yeah, I can see also why people is very attracted to computers, because they got better and better.
Mm-hmm.
Before, I don't know if you remember, computers couldn't space anything.
Yeah.
And they had a specific, like a rectangular shape, the space between words was so awful, because that's what they did to justify it, left and right. And now computers, you can manipulate the space in between letters very well, and it's probably a very time consuming, I think it is. Unless they have gotten even better. I don't do computer work. But probably that was somewhat corrected. And even letterpress has a lot of limitations in the sense that you need to, like when there is an uppercase, and the uppercase in the middle letter has some space around, and then the next letter it's gonna appear too far apart from the uppercase, so you need to cut the letter, the base of the letter, so you need to do a lot of things also, but it's doable in that sense too. I think it was harder to do it with the computers, trying to fit in good space in between, not just letters, but words. But I probably, do you do a lot of computer work?
I've worked with designers, and they are able to manipulate spaces,
yeah, very
in between
well.
Letters.
Yeah.
So I think it has become much better.
Yeah.
Well, you've talked quite a bit. I don't know if you want to end now, or if you want to maybe tackle one more and talk about kind of how your time at the UW as a student impacted your career as a book artist.
Oh, Very much, I think that because of the people that were around me, and because of the support I got when I graduated, oh no, see, that's what happened. When I graduated, when you're a graduate student, you can apply for a called, what is it called? And you actually, it's kind of a practicum, kind of, you can stay in the country for a year.
Okay.
To get
like
more
fellowship.
Experience. No, it's not a fellowship, although it's called, a lot of the students do it, and now they are, it's extended to undergraduates.
Okay.
So you change your visa, you're no longer a student visa, you have another visa that is allowing you to get experience, but for that, you have to have a job.
Okay.
And a job, preferably in the field that you, you know, but I think it's not exclusively, you can be a little off the field. But then I was able to get a job with Walter. So I was hired by him and made paper for his one of his projects, a couple of his projects, or one project, and then I did also became a binder.
Okay.
Book binder for him. And I bound 2 editions. The fantastic, I can never pronounce that, is a book that he did it periodically with...
Oh, Jabberwocky?
With,
Was it the Jabberwocky stuff?
No. It's with his, the entries of his... Yeah.
Gabberjack?
Yeah, that. Where he writes, you know, he keeps a journal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he still does. He has issues with his eyes. But so that was a book that was just beautiful book to do the binding for. So, and another one called Flora, that was poems. And so I was able to also, you know, work for somebody that inspired my work tremendously, and had such a, I mean, he was an inspiration to me. I think his creativity was just tremendous, and having a job, having this job was very good for my, especially the paper making, the book binding. And then Jim Das, you know, also conservator, was supportive of my work. And in general, I felt very appreciated. So I guess that I just only wish I would have been able to make some money when I was a graduate student, because very expensive for me.
Yes.
It was. But there was not that possibility at the time, except when I was able to get that TA ship. And yeah, so it was, the art department was very male oriented. I don't think in my time there, maybe Laura Beth Clark, but there was another person that taught color theory, because she was there when I first came, but she retired. And then, I was hired to teach as a, when I finished, Phil Hamilton was taking a sabbatical.
Okay.
So there was and I applied for it. It wasn't like I was invited to teach, but I applied for it. And I was able to teach typography and graphic design to basic, you know, graphics and as
when
a requirement.
That? When was that?
That was, when was that? Maybe 1991.
Okay.
Maybe 1991. Yeah.
So I just wondered if you could clarify the timeline a little bit. You said that you worked for Silver Buckle Press, you worked with Jim Dast, and you worked with Walter Hamady. Like, kind of, do you remember, like, what order everything happened?
Well, Silver Buckle Press was first.
Okay.
And then I got the TA.
Teaching Spanish?
The Spanish was when I was in graduate school.
Okay, got it.
So I worked at the Silver Buckle first, and then I got the job in the art department as a year appointment.
Okay. And that's when you taught typography?
That's when I taught graphic design.
Sure.
But I actually was working for Walter before that because I finished in 87.
Okay.
And 88 was the year that I had the practice. It's called practical training.
Okay.
Practical training. That's how it was called, and I'm not sure if it still is called like that. But you have the right to stay in the country for a year.
Okay.
So that was the whole year of 1988. And then I worked at the Silver Buckle Press. And I'm not so sure if that overlapped also with Walter.
Okay.
Because probably it did, because since I was in practical training, I had the possibility to work, to get a job, because I had graduated and that was expected from
mm-hmm.
me to have a job. And then in 1991, Phil Hamilton took a sabbatical and I was teaching. But also I taught the same year at Clark College, which
okay.
is in Dubuque.
Oh, wow. So did you
but I
travel
do, I,
there?
Yes, I actually went and came back the same day.
Okay.
So I taught letterpress printing.
Okay.
And the chairman of the department had been my classmate. She was getting an MFA as well. And it was very busy, but very interesting to me both. The class that I was teaching at the university here had to do with just typography.
Mm-hmm.
We did use we didn't use much equipment. The students had to work with the letters in many different ways. And that was kind of fun. That was a little bit like what I did when I was in my own
mm-hmm.
in as a graphic designer. And I even had a graduate student in that class, but he was from Taiwan, so I guess he had to do what I did when I came, level up and take some requirements.
Okay.
And that was a good year for me. I had a lot of teaching experience that I never had when I was in graduate student in the art department. So the trip to Dubuque didn't seem, even though it was the first time I was driving on the road by myself, you know, but it worked out well. I very much liked the group that I had in Dubuque, and it was letterpress, which
mm-hmm.
I loved doing. And later on, I got the job with Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Dast, and that was a part-time job, which was very good. and I was working part-time in my studio here, being very as productive as I could, and everything seemed to be working really well. And he decided to retire, and I was asked to fill in while they look for the conservator.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a good decision to say yes, because then didn't wanna let me go part time.
Okay.
I enjoyed the job tremendously because there are aspects that I were very fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
But it, in many ways, it really interfered with my studio work.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare that there is a lab run by one person. Very rare, especially university library that is large.
Mm-hmm.
Most labs are run, even smaller libraries, by 2-3 people.
Sure.
So it's one of those things that is a lot of aspects are. I had the chance to teach and make these students love the craft of learning.
Mm-hmm.
How it is. For them is practically another class that is for free. We're paying them to learn. I mean, not a lot. Good people don't make a lot of money, but yeah, they could be paid more. But it's been better.
Uh-huh.
They did some changes in the payroll, and it's better. It's more what they should be. But that's what happened.
Okay, well, I think let's stop there for today. Thank you for your time.